Well, hello everyone, and welcome back to Deepest Lore. Today, I don't have a lot of time, friends, so there's not going to be any time for super chats. If anybody sends any, I'll do some. I'll catch up next week. We're going to have to keep this short. We're going to have to keep this within an hour. So we're carrying on with reviewing Adam Curtis. Last episode easily made the 7.8. Thousand required. Just having a look at those numbers now, just to make sure. Pretty sure it did reach it. Easily. This also needs to reach that threshold. A little bit worried for this one because the collapse of Baring's Bank is perhaps not the hottest button topic, given that it happened back in 1995, which is coming up to 30 years ago. Is that right? 2005. Yeah, 30 blood. God, feeling old, friends. Before we get going, let me play an ad. Why don't we go with the old classic today? Pick up the Trivium. Buy it now.
Academic Agency.
So, this one is called Nick Leeson and the Fall of Baring's Bank. It's called £830 million, Nick Leeson and the Fall of the House of Baring's. It was an inside story, which is the same series, I believe, that Curtis contributed the Iranian Revolution one to back in 1989. This was made in 1996. Lesser known Curtis. It's basically like a kind of amuse-bouche, a teaser. What do you call it? An aperitif, that's what I was looking for the Mayfair set, which will be coming up. And hopefully Horace will be joining me for some of those episodes. He's shown great interest in coming on for some of the Mayfair set. Anyway, let's take it away.
I'm here to introduce a fabulous new game. It's called Banking. Everyone's doing it. All you need to play it with are one of these.
Like many. 100% classic Curtis opening sequence there. The guy, by this point in 1996, he just knew what he was doing, didn't he? Let's face it.
In the 1980s, Nick Leeson wanted to be rich and successful. But Nick Leeson was also a very strange man. He had an extraordinary ability to manipulate and deceive those around him. This is his story. It is also the story of those he deceived. They willingly entered into a dream he wove, lured by the prospect of vast sums of money. And together they lost £830 million.
growing confidence and drive owes a good deal to young people. Its vast new dealing rooms are run by the young. People who made it not because of who they know or what school tie they wear, but on sheer merit. And that is the kind of society I want to see.
That was a very good essay by my friend Mike at Imperium Press against merit, against meritocracy, on his Substack recently. There's an audio version of it as well. I'd recommend reading that essay because he really tears down the notion that meritocracy is necessarily the best or the right idea or something that you should aim for. Now, I must admit that I, as someone who has, let's just say, a penchant for min-maxing in games and trying to, you know, go for the most efficient and most effective options, this is something that I have continually struggled with myself, because there's a logic to wanting the best. But Mike does a very good job in that essay of arguing against that, which was, I found, pretty convincing.
In 1986, Mrs. Thatcher deregulated the City of London. The old division between banks and stockbrokers was removed. Gentlemanly.
Shall we see if we can spot Dan from the Lotus Eaters? This is his crew. He's one of those. He's one of those white boys, isn't he? So let's try to spot Dan.
The image of the banker was replaced by that of the trader. Nick Leeson was working as a clerk for the giant American bank, Morgan Stanley. On the surface, he appeared just like everyone else in this new world, a boy from the suburbs who wanted to be a trader.
It's very easy for me to get on with people, but I don't necessarily have to like you or any of the people that I work with to get on with them. So I come in, I do my job, I do it to the best of my ability, and then at the end of the day, if you're going to ask me out for a drink, I'm not going to go out for a drink with you because I don't like you. But I'm not going to tell you that. There's no reason for there to be any animosity during the day. I just didn't like the people that I worked with. And so I would go in, do the work, be very, very friendly. Everybody would probably say that they thought they were my best friend. And if they have the knowledge, then I will attempt to get that knowledge through whichever way is best. And if the friendship is that method, then friendship is the method that I would use.
In 1989, Leeson asked to become a trader, but Morgan Stanley refused. He decided it was time to move. This time he chose a British bank.
It wasn't a money thing. I could have stayed at Morgan Stanley for an extra $5,000, but, you know, if they've stopped me doing something once, who's to say they're not going to do it again? And so I moved to Barings. At that stage, I probably would be happy to say that I'd never heard of Barings.
But it was a famous old bank.
So there's no Barings in Watford.
Barings was the oldest merchant bank in Britain. It had been run by the Baring family for over 200 years. They were related to practically everyone, including Princess Diana and Tiggy Leg Burke. Working for the bank was a family tradition.
I decided to be a banker, not a very conscious decision, when I came down from Oxford in 1950 and had to earn my living, and was able to go into Barings and try my hand there.
Barings Power was its name. It could raise capital on the best of terms because everybody knew that its clients were the cream of British society. Even the Queen held an account at Barings. It was a discreet, safe bank with a deep sense of superiority.
Hard not to believe that this happened for other reasons. I mean, it just so happens of all the banks, this is the one that gets it, you know. Interesting, isn't it?
Barings had a wonderful franchise, particularly in Britain, but it was certainly smug, it was certainly arrogant. It had always been at the heart of the establishment. It had always been regarded really very special. You know, I mean, I think probably the Bank of England gave it considerable indulgence because it was Baring Brothers.
But Barings had a terrible secret in its past, something that even today the family are reluctant to talk about. 100 years ago, the bank sent a young clerk to Argentina. It was the emerging market of its time, and the clerk persuaded Barings to invest in the building of sewers underneath Buenos Aires. Barings sent millions of pounds, hoping to sell the shares in Europe. But no one wanted them, and the bank crashed. Barings was rescued by the Bank of England. But Edward Baring, the head of the bank, was ruined. He never recovered, and his son and grandson went to live in solitude on an island off the Irish coast, accompanied only by three wallabies bought from London Zoo. The name of the clerk who ruined the bank was Nicholas Bower. Nick Leeson went to work for Baring Securities. 6 years before, they had been a small team of stockbrokers. Now they contributed over half the profits of the bank. But behind this 80s success story, Leeson found an operation run on a shoestring.
Just a totally different environment. There was, at Morgan Stanley, everything was new. You know, all of the equipment was new. The furniture was new. At Barings, everything is, just tacky, I suppose. I can't describe it any other way. The futures and options department was operating on a PC and on a software program that was written by one of the people that I worked with. It was very much on the back of Matchbox type things.
Interesting, isn't it? Interesting. Old money and new money within the banking world. But I still find it interesting that something as close to the British establishment was essentially neutral orbit at this time, whether it was planned or not, probably not. But it's just interesting that that is the one that gets it at a time of terminal decline in British power.
And there were a lot of problems.
Leeson had joined an organisation falling apart after the boom of the 80s. He worked as a bookkeeper, trying to keep track of the bank's money. And he was good at it. Soon he was sent overseas to sort out problems. In Jakarta, he found huge sums of money owed to the bank by its clients.
It was typical Barings. Barings had paid for a lot of stock and hadn't actually received anything back from the customers. And the figure was £100 million. They just didn't have the right people in place to control it and monitor the settlements. You know, they'd go in and do the dealing and everything okay, but then just the back office would fall apart all the time. You know, it was typical Barings.
In Jakarta, Leeson met another clerk working for Barings, Lisa Sims.
You don't sort of wake up one day and think, I'm attracted to Nick, because you just grow on each other. Things that things that Nick could make me laugh. He is quite funny, he does make you laugh. And he is quite friendly.
How ambitious was he?
Very. You could just tell, the minute you're in the working with Nick, he was in control of everything and very ambitious, and he wanted to get things done.
In March 1992, Nick married Lisa. 10 days before the wedding, he had received some good news. He was to be a trader at last. Barings wanted him to go and run their futures operation in Singapore. Leeson asked Lisa to leave her job and come with him, and she agreed.
I thought, I want to spend the rest of my life with Nick. All I wanted was my little house, a car, 2.4 children, and to be happy. What everyone wants, really, just to be comfortable. And I thought that's what Nick wanted too.
Leeson was going to trade in one of the newest and most exciting of the financial markets, futures. He went to work on Cymex, Singapore's international monetary exchange, in the heart of the city's financial district. Leeson's job was to buy and sell futures. These are bets on the way a market will move in the future. He traded on the Nikkei, the Japanese stock market. He was acting under orders from both the bank and its clients. If the market moved the way they had predicted, they made money. If it didn't, their losses mounted rapidly.
Nick is a really cool person on the floor. You won't believe it. And everybody is all...
He's been there, I reckon. I reckon Nick has been there. What do you reckon?
excited and anxious, and he would be just holding the line, and then he just report the figure to the line, on the other line. And then the next moment, once he get instruction of selling or buying, him, he would go shouting to the boy on the floor, and they would all listen to him, and they would do it very fast. And maybe within a minute or whatever, he could have buy 500 and sell 500 lots. He's real cool, real cool.
It was hard work, you know. There was a lot of pressure. I prefer the pressure, you know, more than anything else. Whether it was the excitement, I can't really say.
The constant pressure for traders is to predict which way the market will move. All around them are screens telling them what is happening in the world.
These screens are the traders' link to the outside world. They're looking at the headlines, looking at the stories, and they're watching how the market is being affected by these headlines. And they're trading on it. Wars, assassinations, disasters are among the biggest things. Earthquakes, storms. When you're looking at it on a screen, it all seems to move very fast because it's coming from everywhere. But the uncertainty causes opportunity. If everyone's thinking one way and something shakes the market, there's a few minutes when no one knows what to think. And that's when you need to make your trade. It's the rush for profits.
See, think about this now, right? Think about what he just said. Now think about if you had leverage over governments who can create events in the world. You can just put those two things together and you can then think of the possibilities.
Summer of 1992, the market fluctuated violently. In the chaos, Leeson's team began to make serious mistakes.
Mistakes are always done by very new traders, new linemen. When the customer say, sell one lot, and then she went, buy one lot. You know, instead of putting here, sell one lot like this, and she put like that. So instead of selling one lot now, you have to sell 11 lots.
Well, do you cover it or don't you cover it? And at the same time, the market was sometimes up 1,000 points. There were 4 or 5 days when it was going up 1,000 points in a row. So if you're out 500 contracts and you're looking at 1,000 points, you're looking at $2.5 million. It's an awful lot of money.
And they always go, boss, I make a mistake. And then Nick will go, okay, I settle it.
There's not a lot I can do about it at 11 o'clock on a Friday night. And, you know, by the time Monday comes around, the market's probably opened up a little bit higher. So now the loss has increased.
The normal response of a trader would be to tell head office. But instead, Leeson hid the losses. He didn't want to go back to being a clerk. He put the losses into a computerised account called the 5/8 account and altered its software so London wouldn't see what he was doing.
My God.
His only problem then were margin payments.
What a... what a stupid thing to do. That was a, you know, yeah, it's not going to do this, and let's just change the record, shall we? I mean, it's probably why he's in jail, or probably why he went to jail.
These are small down payments made on every future. The bank later gets the money back from its clients. The only way to get this money was to ask London. So Leeson took a chance. He told head office it was for futures he had bought for clients. But the clients didn't exist. It was a blatant lie.
From the first time I do anything, I'm not expecting to survive anything more than 2 days. As you get past the two-day period, then you start to get more confidence because it isn't being found. If it's not found after 2 days, when is it going to be found? To me, it's obvious. If they can't see it after 2 days, then who says they're going to see it after 200 days, 500 days, 1,000 days? You know, so you start to get a little bit... You don't get confident, but you're getting away with it. It's easy.
As the weeks passed, London carried on sending Leeson money. They failed to notice that there was no equivalent money coming in from clients. Leeson had discovered a weakness in the system. He would hide his mistakes and trade out of them in his own time, and no one would ever know. But the weakness that Leeson had discovered was just one crack in an organisation that was falling apart. Baring Securities was in crisis. By the summer of 1992, its operating losses were £39 million. The parent bank decided to move in a traditional banker. His name was Peter Norris.
How shocked were you by the lack of control in that when you got in there and began to work there?
I was shocked. I was shocked. Because I didn't feel that it should have been allowed to reach that point.
It was a clash of cultures. Peter Norris was a merchant banker. He believed in control and good bookkeeping. The culture he met in Baring Securities was that of the 80s, a buccaneering spirit where controls were seen as a hindrance.
One of the things I'm a little bit confused about is the distinction between a merchant bank and an investment bank. What's the difference between those two things? Let me just have a look. Okay. So a merchant bank. I'll just get this up for the benefit of everybody. So an investment bank, and I've got a video in my back catalogue called "All About Investment Banks," where I explain exactly what they do. Yeah, they do IPOs. Floating stuff on the stock market. You know, when a company wants to go public, they facilitate that for a fee. They conduct trades on behalf of clients, and they assist in mergers and acquisitions. But what do merchant banks do? They partake in international finance. They focus on small sale companies. Clients include high net worth individuals. They don't do mergers and acquisitions. All right. So it seems like, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, finance types, but I understood it as the buy side and the sell side back when I was working with some of these people, and the investment banks sat on the sell side, but it was the clients on the buy side who were actually, doing the trades, doing the trading. Does that mean the merchant banks were sitting on the buy side, or like I don't really understand where they sat in the whole system? I never came across merchant banks. It was always like hedge funds and, you know, trading firms and people like that. It wasn't a merchant bank. So I would love that to have that cleared up by somebody. Anyway, let us continue.
Making money. But as Leeson had discovered, this attitude bred chaos.
There was a culture which said that businesses of that type operated far better in an informal environment than a formal environment. I think that that was a significant error of judgment.
So Leeson's not completely wrong?
No.
Baring Brothers decided to take over Baring Securities. The cowboys of the 80s were kicked out, and Peter Norris moved his own team in. They set about counting the money and imposing controls. Norris became the chief executive. If he didn't stop the losses, Baring Securities might go bankrupt.
If operating losses had continued at the level they were, that could have had a very serious effect on that business's ability to finance itself. Maybe derailed because of that. It was a bad time.
Frightening?
I find it quite frightening, yes.
But the bank's losses were actually much higher than Norris realised. Leeson's deception had gone badly wrong. 1992, the market had gone against him. As it did so, the losses he had hidden mounted up. The secret 5/8 account turned into a monster with a life of its own. At one point, it held losses of £4 million.
A massive loss. I mean, it was a massive loss. But, and the margin payments were increasing. The market was going against me on a daily basis. And something had to be done about it. And the loss was just accelerating. You know, it starts to get pretty frightening. You know, I'm not sleeping at night.
But Leeson decided to go on. He took the classic gambler strategy. He doubled up. Secretly, he bought hundreds more futures. It was incredibly dangerous and against all the bank's rules.
It is just mental that this could happen. Isn't it just crazy that this one guy could do this?
but it meant that if the market did move his way, he would make a great deal of money and wipe out his losses.
Why did I choose to go on? What is the option to choosing to go on, to deciding to go on? You know, you have to realise the loss. I didn't want to cause Barings to lose all this money. So I'm operating in the belief that I can get it back. You know, maybe it goes back to the confidence thing. I don't know. I mean, I'm confident I can get it back at that stage, I suppose.
Then suddenly, in the spring of 1993, the market did move his way. Day by day, he made hundreds of thousands of pounds. And in July, he wiped out his losses.
Amazing. Amazing.
Success. You know, I was elated. You know, I mean, we had a barbecue at home with some friends and then playing a stupid game afterwards, Pictionary or something like that, all getting pretty drunk around my apartment in Singapore. And, you know, I was happy. The nightmare was over.
There was a big group of us, but we were out on the... We had, like, a little balcony. And Nick just said that he'd been under a lot of pressure at work and that he'd lost money. And that... But now, you know, he'd recouped the losses and everything was OK. And then I said, well, how much did you lose? And Nick said, £1 million.
I just told her that we'd had a problem and, you know, I'd been covering up a few trades and just told her a figure. I don't know what I used, $1 million or something.
But then reading the book, I find out it was £6 million. I mean, just as well he didn't tell me it was £6 million at the time, because I think I would have hit the roof. I fainted first and it scraped me up first and then I would have sort of torn him off. But I just think... Oh, you know, it was just, it's unreal, that money. I mean, £6 million was terrible to, you know, I thought, oh, Nick, think about us in the future rather than protecting them.
And don't do it again.
And on the Monday, he did it again, by all accounts.
Why do you think he did that?
Because I don't think he wanted to be seen as a failure. I suppose he only wanted, like I said, everyone wants to be seen as a success. I suppose he thought, well, I've done it before and it worked out. OK, maybe I can do it again. I don't know why he did it. That's questions I need to ask Nick.
You just lived through 9 months of what you described as a nightmare. And here you are, started it again.
I'm not a psychologist. I can't explain it. But, yeah, I didn't want to let the people down.
Leeson started his deception again. But this time, it was not to cover up other people's mistakes. It was a deliberate fraud. He began to use his secret account to give his clients cut-price deals. He sold them futures at unreal prices, making a loss for himself. He then took these losses and hid them away in the secret account. Leeson had found a way of making himself seem a success. He would be the clever trader he'd always wanted to be. No one would ever know that this was a lie, that hidden away in the 5/8 account were mounting losses. He would trade out of them, just as he had before. Or so he thought.
My word is my bond. On such strong and simple concepts was built the City of London. Throughout the world, both are synonymous with honesty, fair dealing, integrity.
In September 1993, Peter Baring, the chairman of Baring's Bank, visited the Bank of England. He told them that the takeover of Baring Securities had gone well. The recovery in profitability, he said, has been amazing. We conclude that it is not actually very difficult to make money in the securities business. The traditional bankers were now fully in charge. Norris brought in a tough new head of in-house trading, Ron Baker. Although Leeson was not part of Baker's group, he contributed to its profits. And Baker noticed a surprising amount of money coming from Leeson's activities.
My concerns were, here's something that we're seeing which we weren't expecting to see, where the profitability is growing, and one needs to be cynical about growing profits and know exactly how they're produced. In May, I went down there and met the people that were there. What struck you was that he was a complex guy. There was no doubt when you met Nick that he was complicated and that there were things going on below the surface that didn't come out naturally in conversation. I suppose that my overriding impression was of somebody who was very polite, somewhat overly deferent.
The man standing in front of Baker was actually hiding losses of £94 million. Throughout the end of 1993, chaotic world events had pushed the market against Leeson. He had tried to double up, but this time it hadn't worked. He was now at the mercy of the market. On some days, he lost more than £1 million.
It was out of hand, you know. The market movements that I'm allowing are increasing at the same time. Everything is increasing, you know, my capability to accept the loss, the capability to accept a larger market movement, the capability to accept a larger position. Everything increases during the period, you know, everything's building. How did that feel? I lost.
I felt we needed to investigate the operation, and I felt that he as an individual seemed immature and a guy who was struggling with his changing role. But
did you think he was hiding something?
No, I didn't think he was hiding something. I thought he was somebody who was having trouble adjusting to the need to talk to senior people about what he did.
Leeson was also being noticed by those in charge of sending him money. As his losses mounted, he told the usual story. The money was for clients. But the new man had noticed there was something wrong. These clients weren't paying their bills. For the first time, an internal audit was being done, and they told the auditors of the problem. In July, the auditors flew to Singapore. By this time, the secret 5/8 account held losses of more than £100 million.
You have to expect everything to be found. They're supposed to, you know, the nature of an audit is that they're supposed to test information and test documents. Now, if you picked up any document, it had the 5/8 account on it. You know, in some way or form, any document had the 5/8 account on it. So, of course, I'm worried. They come in and they don't test any records. So I can't be happier. They didn't test one record. One report. Yeah, I mean, it's not an audit.
Leeson says that he was convinced he was going to be discovered and it would have been easy to discover him, and they didn't.
Right.
He portrays himself almost as a passive figure. Do you think that's true?
No. I mean, it's only my... It can only be my... speculation about it, of course, but I think he conducted a determined, completely unscrupulous and ultimately extremely successful campaign to avoid discovery through that audit.
Yeah, it's complete amazement, but as you get to know the people at Barings, you can then understand the amazement. A lot of them are just bumbling fools. And that's not me saying that with hindsight. I think if anybody met them, they would get that impression. They come out of some of the reports quite well because they're allowed to say what they like, and I don't have an opportunity to answer back and make their comments look stupid, which they are.
Well, I think he's a highly intelligent creature with a very highly developed skill in manipulating people around him in a quite extraordinary way. He's like a virus that gets into the workings of something that does work and perverts it utterly. He's an agent of destruction.
Like a kind of Iago figure, according to Norris. Seems kind of true. I mean, when he was... When he was kind of free of it and he cleared the losses, that would be the moment that any normal person would decide, right, that's it now, I've got away with that. It's just, but he then would decided to go turbo mode.
The auditors returned to London full of praise for Leeson. They worried about his dual role as both trader and bookkeeper, but they completely failed to spot the most obvious evidence of his fraud. The money being forwarded to Leeson every day was not being repaid to the bank. There were no clients, but the auditors hadn't noticed.
Was it Nick or was it the auditors?
I think it's the auditors in the end. Nick would probably have been clever, probably distracted people, but at the end of the day, there's a job there to be done.
How could they possibly not notice? I mean, no clients. Bills aren't being paid. Hello?
It seems to me that they began to associate the commercial success of the organisation somehow or other with the lack of controls. You ran a London investment bank with pristine controls, which you polished regularly, but a global stockbroker was a very different business, and maybe that was a business in which you let it rock and roll a little bit more than you did with the merchant bank, because that was the way that business had been successfully run. The people that were sent in to fix the controls were seduced by the commercial success of the organisation and lost their way.
To the traditional bankers from Barings, the 80s culture they had taken over was strange and alien, but it was one that was making them a great deal of money, far more than they had made as merchant bankers. But what made that money was a willingness to cut corners and cheat customers. It was a culture that Leeson knew well, where extra profits were often skimmed off clients' accounts.
There's a lot of funny stuff that goes on. You see it in the back office. I mean, at Barings, for instance, they have so many different suspense accounts where trades are fed through so that they can book the profits off to different accounts, especially on the futures and options side. That if they looked at those specific accounts, I think that there could be something there that is illegal. Some of the charges that I am currently going to be tried on in Singapore, and it's standard practice in the industry.
And who wins out of that?
The company.
So, I mean, I'm just trying to figure this out. The merchant bank is basically an investment bank that doesn't do the other parts, doesn't do the IPOs and doesn't do the mergers and acquisitions. It simply executes trades. So it's like a sell, it's like a just a pure sell side function, where if you're a wealthy investor, you pay them to execute the trade. I think that is what it is. But it seems like from watching this, that they had more control over what to invest in as well. So I'm still a little bit confused as to what they actually did or what their actual role was. And it's going to continue to bug me throughout this.
And they were lining their own pockets through doing these types of deals.
There is nothing quite as wonderful as money,
money, money.
There is nothing like a newly minted
money, 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 money.
Everyone must hanker for the butchness of a banker. It's accountancy that makes the world go round, round, round. You can keep your watch's ways, but it's only just a phase. Money, money, money makes the world.
The audit reassured Leeson's new bosses. He was now seen as a clever trader living the high life in Singapore. But by the autumn of 1994, his secret losses totaled £160 million. And he found himself in a terrible trap. To stop London being suspicious, he had to seem to be making huge profits. In fact, his profits were small. So he did something extraordinary. He used his secret account to buy futures off himself at fantastic prices. By doing this, he was able to fake huge profits. But his hidden losses grew even more.
Bloody hell.
It was a vicious circle. He kept on having to do irrational things that would lose money on the exchange in order to produce the accounting effect necessary to continue to conceal. And so long as he could continue to get the cash, then it didn't matter whether he did things that were unprofitable. Because in his own fantasy world, He was a star.
So I'm still trying to get my head around exactly what was happening here, okay? There's an account that, in theory, belongs to a client, an investor, which obviously has a balance, you know, and it's like, you know, it's, you know, making a buying futures when it, you know, and that is going up and down, up and down. Okay. But the money he is receiving are the fees for executing those trades, the PIP or whatever they call it. And that is the profits that he is showing. But obviously the trades that are being bought by the account are losing money. I think that is what is happening here, but it's not been fully explained by Curtis, possibly because he does not understand it himself. But let's carry on.
You had almost a psychotic sort of figure toward the end of 1994. On the one hand, the powerful trader supposedly making profits. On the other hand, the reality of the continual loser, having to do irrational things that would lose money.
I'll go down the betting shop, I'll put the old lot on horse. Horse comes in last, I'll put bleeding more on. Horse comes in last again, I'll put bleeding more on. Horse is dead, I'll put bleeding more on. I'll go down the butcher, I say, oi, mate, I want £1,000 on that piece of meat to win the derby. No, second thoughts, put some bleeding more on. That's what the old butcher calls me, bleeding more on.
Leeson was now on a merry-go-round he couldn't get off. Each time he declared more profits, he became more of a star. But in reality, each time he did this, his losses grew. It was an absurd situation, but on the surface, he was supremely self-confident. This film, taken at the end of 1994, shows everyone looking anxiously at the screens, except for one man on the right, Nick Leeson, who was now known as the King of the Exchange.
Yeah, it does make you look back and think, obviously, I don't know Nick. I thought I did. I thought I knew him really well. Obviously, there's a side to Nick that I didn't know. I only knew his colleagues and the friends of ours that worked on the floor. And they only ever fed me with success stories saying how well Nick was doing, what a good trader he was. So I just thought things were fine. The fibs, the lies, that's what makes me angry. Why lie? I'm his wife. I mean, I'm his wife. Why should he lie? I mean, I suppose lots of wives think that when they find out their husbands have been having an affair and they think, well, you know, they've been leading a double life. And that's what it feels like. Not that Nick's had an affair. It feels like Nick was leading a double life.
Leeson was now trapped by his own fake success. It was escalating out of his control. In September, the Singapore Exchange celebrated its 10th anniversary. The guest of honour was Lee Kuan Yew, the country's leader. That night, he announced Singapore's own version of the Big Bang, due partly, he said, to Simex's recent successes.
And now Simex celebrates its 10th anniversary. 10 years of continuous growth in liquidity.
Everyone knew that the man behind much of this success was the King of the Exchange, Nick Leeson. And Barings was to receive two awards that night.
Okay.
The dynamic growth of the region has made financial markets an important conduit for users and suppliers of capital. We have to change and to liberalize to stay ahead.
So it was like a glory day for Barings. Everybody was so happy and so proud of ourselves. We thought that Nick is the one who's going to receive the prize on the stage. But Nick wouldn't go on stage to receive the award.
I mean, I know it's a lie, but how did I feel? I mean, you know, it's another thing that's increasing the pressure inside me because it's being opened up to a wider circle. And they're seeing this same image, which I know to be so false. Because they weren't true prophets. The 5/8 account would have totally wiped out the profits that were being reported.
So you were a fraud?
Correct.
Now, Bill is somewhere in the hall, I know. He's probably celebrating some wonderful news he's had today.
There he is.
Billy Fisher, the man himself.
Congratulations, Billy. Congratulations and best of luck.
Billy Lawyer! Billy Lawyer! Billy Lawyer!
So I don't think he ever really was a traitor. I think that was the fantasy. And to keep the fantasy going...
She just mentioned Curtis's ability to pick out the exactly right clip to use is a supreme talent. He must have searched for ages to find that exact right clip to use there. Anyway, let's carry on.
He needed two things. One was the cash from London and the other one was the concealment of the losses. So the concealment let him continue to enjoy the fantasy. But when the fantasy broke and he was forced to come back and deal with the fact that he really was a loser, what nourishes and sustains him is his ability to fool people, to be able to be one step ahead, to be able to make them believe in something that's created by him as an illusion.
He must have been in a very dark place, this chap. What a terrible situation to be in. But, I mean, he kind of willfully took a decision to do it, as we saw.
Everyone now believed the illusion that Leeson had created. In December, he was flown to New York. Barings was holding a conference for many of its traders from around the world. And Nick Leeson was the star. He had made, it appeared, £28 million turnover that year. He was held up as the model for the future of the bank, the Cymex model.
Lots of people were there. It was probably the biggest sort of thing on this sort of basis that they'd done for Barings. And it really was, I presume, on the back of the profits that I was reporting out of Singapore. And there's all these people are doing these presentations and they're thinking, shit, we're going to make a load of money this year. Look at how much money Singapore's got. Now,
can you imagine the shit that was talked at that conference? They were all on the basis of this. That conference will have had so many papers talking absolute rubbish. It's amazing to think about. And something he said earlier on has made me wonder how much this is the one that was caught. How much other shit like this has happened over the years with these people? Anyway, let's carry on.
Do I need that? No.
Leeson faced an audience of executives who badly wanted to believe in him. All of them were to get vast bonuses that year. Some, like Ron Baker, of nearly £1 million. Much of this was to come from Leeson's profits. But there were traders in the audience who didn't believe Leeson. They couldn't see how such fantastic profits could come from low-risk trading. But Barings' executives dismissed their worries.
Is it possible to make such profits for what Leeson was supposed to be doing?
Yes. And I think I think if we had had somebody that was skillful, that was earnest, and that was attempting to fulfil that commercial strategy... as honestly as they could within Cymex during that year, that we would have made money, decent money out of that activity.
See, this is where I really need to understand the mechanism of what's happening, because I believe that the £28 million profit that they're talking about here is basically the pip for executing the trade, and the actual win or loss of the client, which is this secret account that he's got, doesn't really matter, because that doesn't really go against the, you know, that's the investor's money, right? So it is, I mean, let's just pretend that he was able to attract all of those different trades. It would be perfectly possible to make that money, whether the clients won or lost money, if that makes any sense. I guess the... that is my understanding. I guess then the question would be, could he attract that level of custom? Could he have that many people going to him? Right? I'm going to need Dan to look over this or someone, Black Horse or someone like that to explain to me if I've got this wrong. But if my understanding of what the actual role of Barings Bank was here, whether the account won or lost money is kind of irrelevant. The problem is that in this case, the money being invested, if you want, was the bank's own money in this secret account, not a client.
We have made £28 million. I think it's possible.
It is simply not the case that it's impossible for institutions like Barings to make very considerable profits from financial transactions with very little or virtually no risk.
So when people say...
So, see, because they're making money on the transaction, it doesn't... They basically win or loss, right? You execute a buy, you execute the sell. And whether you make money or lose money, the bank still gets paid. You understand? It's like how a casino takes a rake of whatever win, you know, of the winnings, takes a little rake for themselves. That is how Leeson was saying that he was making money. The problem is that his sales, if you want to put it in those terms, were coming from a client that didn't exist. That is the fraud. So in a sense, that account, the secret account, whether it was winning or losing money, if it was a real client, wouldn't be relevant. Do you understand what I'm saying? Anyway, I don't want to get too hung up on this because we don't have a lot of time.
They should have known that it was impossible to make high profits with low risk. They're wrong.
I think they're wrong, yes.
The reason that Barings executives believed there was no risk was yet another deception by Leeson. They thought he had offset all his futures. This meant that for every bet he had made, Leeson had an insurance policy. He had made an equal bet on the market moving the other way. But like all of Leeson's activities, this too was a lie. None of his futures were offset.
I'd never queried for an instant the basic premise of this business, which was that it was an offset. It never even occurred to me that fundamental point was untrue.
Leeson's positions on the exchange were now vast. Every night he asked for hundreds of thousands of pounds in margin payments, and Barings paid it.
Okay, so I mean, now they're making it sound like he's actually making his own trades. If I say like he is making the call, which would make him closer to being an account holder or, you know, someone actually responsible for making the calls. Which means it does matter if they're making money or not. He's not making money on the pip. He's making money by buying and selling. This is extremely confusing because it's not been outlined properly in the documentary. So one of my issues with documentaries on Wall Street is that they never explain the mechanisms that I'm talking about here. Which people within the industry know about, possibly because they don't want you to know about it. But it's important. It is actually important for getting your head around what he was actually doing. Anyway, let's carry on. Because it seems like he was operating. Somebody would give him money to invest. That's more like an account manager at a trading firm, rather than someone on the investment bank side who's just executing the trades. Anyway, let us carry on. I don't want to get too hung up on this because we'll never finish otherwise.
Yet those in charge of sending him this money knew there was something seriously wrong. The bank's treasurer, Tony Hawes, knew that there was nothing like this amount coming in from clients. He worried, but he didn't do very much. Those who ran Barings were not only mesmerized by Leeson's profits, they didn't understand the very basics of the business they had taken over. Mr. Hawes has declined to be interviewed.
So senior managers within Barings Bank knew that there were vast differences between what Leeson was asking for and what you were being given, yet you were never told?
Yeah.
Should you have been told?
Well, of course, you say... yes, I should. I should.
Why didn't you know?
Well, fundamentally, because it wasn't raised in that way.
Why not?
I don't know. I don't know.
But why didn't those people who ran Barings come to you and say, what are you doing?
Because they're stupid. They don't understand the business and they should never have been in the position that they were in. Especially people like Tony Hawes. He was supposed to be controlling the global treasury function. He was supposed to understand derivatives. He didn't. And he would pay the money every single day and would accept, you know, pretty ridiculous explanations from me. It wouldn't happen at Morgan Stanley. At Barings, they had a lot of idiots, basically, in every one of the controlling functions. They were asking questions, but they weren't going deep enough. They didn't understand the basics of the business.
The basics of the business have also not been explained by this documentary. I have tried to explain some along the way, but in the stuff I looked at, there was never any merchant banks. You see, this is where I've got confused. So I still don't really understand where they sit in the overall system. The fact they've got clients means that they are executing trades on behalf of somebody else. But what I'm confused about is it also seems like he is making the call of what to buy and sell, which means he's operating more like a kind of a broker, I guess. But still, the money would go to the client and he would just take a fee, right? But that mechanism has not been explained in the documentary. So, and it does make a difference because... if they're only making money on the fee, then the performance of the bets, if you want to put it that way, are less relevant for the bank. Whereas if this is an account that he is in charge of as a buy side, like if they're on the buy side, if you want to put it that way, rather than the sell side, then the performance of those accounts matters greatly. Because they hold those accounts with Barings. Anyway, let's carry on.
And you were creating a large amount of profits?
Fictitiously, yeah. But they were also paying me an awful lot of money that they couldn't justify. So if you were thinking that the profits were real and yet you were still paying 10 times as much in money that you couldn't account for, what is the natural conclusion? Something is wrong.
By the end of 1994, the equivalent of three quarters of Barings' capital had been sent to Leeson. The oldest merchant bank in Britain had placed £330 million on the activities of one man.
You see, there is no actual excuse for this on the institutional side. Three quarters of their capital went to one dude, and not a single person in accounts or the audit team or anybody was like, hold on a second, what's going on here? He's right that they are idiots.
Such was the power of the illusion that Leeson had created that the men who ran the bank began to entertain strange dreams. The chairman, Peter Baring, believed his family bank had returned to the glories of its past. It had recaptured the global position it had lost 100 years ago. That Christmas, Leeson went on holiday to Ireland with his wife. He decided to tell her they weren't returning to Singapore.
I'm trying to tell Lisa that I don't want to go back. Pressure's too much.
What does she say?
You know, she knows what the bonus figure is. The proposed bonus figure is supposed to be £450,000.
It was just this bonus. Imagine, £450,000 is such a lot of money. You know, it would have set us up for the rest of our lives. You know, every week I sort of do six, you know, scratch my six number, do my six numbers to think I could have a chance of winning that kind of money. You dream about that kind of money. And to think that Nick had worked so hard to achieve it, and then he said he didn't want to go back. I couldn't understand it, but he couldn't tell me why, and he didn't tell me.
I just can't. I can't face up to it. I don't know. You have to ask a psychologist. It's the thing of letting people down. I just can't do it. You know, maybe I try too hard to please. I can't give you an explanation.
So Leeson returned to Singapore. For a few days in January, things went his way. He had thousands of futures hidden in the secret account. Provided the market kept steady, they could still make a lot of money.
He was gambling that the Japanese stock market would go nowhere. It was a logical assumption. There were no political factors, there were no economic factors that reasonably could have moved the market up or down. If the market had simply remained quiet, the whole position would have worked out well. But the problem with that is that generally after long periods of time when nothing has happened and when we cannot really see any reason for something to happen, invariably it does.
The effect of the Kobe earthquake on the Japanese stock market was disastrous. Immediately, the Nikkei began to plunge.
It was bad, you know. But again, it's living to fight another day, really. I mean, what did I feel? I didn't go home and cut my wrists. I didn't go and jump out of a building, you know. Some people would do that. But, you know, without the choice of running away from it, you know, I had to... Barings were still paying me money, don't forget. They're still paying me masses of money, you know. I mean, we'd ask for sometimes for $100 million. They'd pay it.
Leeson decided to take one last desperate gamble.
So I still can't get my head around this mechanism. They're sending him the money to then bet, but the money is meant to be client's money. And he takes that money and he sticks it in that secret account. Okay, that there is one aspect of this that I don't really understand what Barings were in the business of doing here, because it does not accord with the various maps and things that I have presented before in my video on investment banks, and the talk I used to give at work where I'd explain all this stuff. I just can't get my head around where they sat. It's going to take one of the finance bros to explain it, what they were doing, or what was that account? What was Leeson's actual job in the chain? Was he on the buy side or the sell side? And if he was on the buy side, then the client's money is effectively an account being managed by Barings to invest on their behalf. So the money would then have to go back to the clients, right? But he's hiding it in the secret account. So what's that secret account then? Now, to me, it makes sense if he is just simply making money on transactions from a client that does not exist. But the fact that they keep on sending him money makes me wonder. Because we're also like... That money they're sending him presumably came from real clients. So what happened to it? Anyway, let's carry on.
Using Barings' money, he bought thousands more futures. He was single-handedly going to try and hold the market up.
If you're desperate enough and you're that frightened of a huge loss, you take the leap of faith and try to hold up the entire market. You can feel it slipping away. You can feel it slipping out of your hands. But, you know, you can't exactly pull it back. You do something desperate, like try to buy thousands of futures of contracts and hold a future and hold a market up.
He was like boom, 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 up and down the pit, running there, buy, and or sell, and then he couldn't make it, and then he went to another pit. He looked a bit crazy on the floor already. He doesn't really care anymore. He doesn't care how much mistake you make anymore. He just say, okay. He doesn't care how big is the mistake you have made anymore. Because what is one lot to 10,000 lots different?
In the days following Kobe, Leeson took a terrifying switchback ride on the futures market. If the market moved up only a few points, he made millions of pounds in seconds.
So the numbers scared me. I didn't really want to know what the numbers were. I was hiding from the numbers as much as possible. It was out of hand, you know. It had just gone completely crazy. How it was continuing to go on a day-to-day basis, I just can't explain to you.
But Leeson's strategy failed. The market began to fall again. His losses were catastrophic. On one day alone, he lost £50 million. But he kept going. To do so, he needed vast margin payments from London.
Every day that I make one of these requests for additional money, I never expect it to come. I expect somebody to say, look, Nick, what the hell's going on? We've got £30 million from our customers, and yet you need £300 million to finance them. How do you explain that? You can't. You literally cannot. Why do you need... What possible explanation could there be for needing £300 million to finance a business that has a total exposure to the market of 30? You can't do it. So, you know, but it happened.
But Leeson was more than the passive figure he portrays himself as. To get this money, he kept on declaring fake profits, but now on a phenomenal scale. In 1 week, he declared $10 million profit. It was something that no one had ever seen before. But Barings believed him.
I can't explain it because it's not a commercial reaction. I mean, a commercial reaction said, well, you know, how on earth is this man making this money? Nobody else on earth is doing it this way. It defies imagination. A trader would know that that could not be achieved. There was either something fundamentally wrong with the market, or the man was taking risks, very, very big risks. So how, and it's not just Peter Norris, but Peter Baring, the whole board, looked at these results and appear completely to have believed them? I just don't understand it.
I was pleased at the success of that business over that period, of course. You know, Mad Hatter's Tea Party.
By now, Barings was scouring the world's money markets to find the money to fund Leeson. But on the 24th of January, they went over their overdraft limit with Citibank, and a meeting was called to discuss Leeson. Worries were expressed about the size of his positions, but the bank's executives agreed amongst themselves that Leeson was doing rather well. His profits were high, they told one another, precisely because of the Kobe earthquake. It had produced chaos in the markets, which Leeson was cleverly exploiting.
In retrospect, one has to say that virtually everything about that discussion was absolutely mad. And that we were living in a world through the looking glass where logic was apparent, but was actually completely perverted. It seems completely bizarre. A group of rational, intelligent, experienced, competent people were dealing with the matter in a way which was totally at variance with reality.
You mean they were blinded by the profits?
What I'm sorry to keep on coming back to this over and over and over again, but it's very important for me to understand something properly. Are they saying that he made £10 million from, you know, buying and selling, and that is the difference between what he bought at and what he sold at? Or are they saying that he made £10 million in profits by attracting business from clients and doing transactions and getting the pip? Because in my mind, the £10 million does not sound like a lot of money if it's the former. If it's the latter, it's obviously cloud cuckoo land. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because the execution fee is quite small, whereas you can have big trading firms can make a lot of money in one day just by buying low and selling high. And you understand why I'm fixated on this, right? Because they have consistently throughout this talked about profits. And they tend not to talk about, the former in terms of profits, at least in my experience. So anyway, let's carry on. Probably everybody's going to be annoyed by me, my autistic fixation on this one point, but it's particularly important to understand what exactly happened.
So it's a question of degree. I think it's more that critical faculties were less engaged than they might have been, to put it at its least, because there were profits.
Yes! There's more money!
But even when the truth stared them in the face, Baring still kept sending Leeson money. The bank's auditors now discovered a £50 million loss which Leeson hadn't managed to hide. Using scissors and glue at home, Leeson concocted paperwork that showed it was a loan to another bank. He faxed it through to the auditors. He forgot that on the top would be printed, "From Nick and Lisa."
Completely ludicrous, and it doesn't hold up to investigation. But it was accepted. I don't know how, but, it was accepted.
Why?
I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm an unbelievable person. I don't know.
But then finally, on the 17th of February, a clerk working for Baring's found strange discrepancies in Leeson's accounts. For 6 days, Leeson eluded him. On the 7th, Leeson decided it was time to go.
So I come up with this story about Lucy not being well and I needing to go home to see her, and I'd be back in 45 minutes. And we tie up a few loose ends that we had to do, and then we leave. I mean, it was a fight getting Lisa to leave. I'm telling her that's a
problem.
I told her it was a problem. I didn't go any further than that.
He said, I need to have a chat. Fine. So we had to drive in the car, and he said that he's under lots of pressure at work. If he didn't get away and think about things, he'd have a nervous breakdown.
That's how I rationalised it in the end to her, to get her to agree to come. We took some golf clubs back that I'd borrowed the week before to one of Lisa's friends. We went to a shop and picked up a deposit that we'd had for laser discs, picked that up. Had a cup of tea and some chocolate biscuits.
Went home, packed the suitcases, and we took off to the airport.
We tried to find Leeson in Singapore. But two people from London got into the office and started cracking open drawers and computers. And in a sense, that's the end of the story. I realised that insolvency was a real threat.
Good evening. Crisis talks have been going on all day at the Bank of England to work out a deal to save Britain's oldest merchant bank. Barings is facing bankruptcy after one of its traders lost nearly £400 million on dealings in the Far East. He has now vanished. The Bank of England is racing to arrange a rescue before the Tokyo stock market opens in a few hours' time.
Leeson and his wife had fled to a luxury resort on the Malay...
Look at that. After all that, they were still thinking about bailing it out. The Bank of England was still going to think about rescuing it. And you and me and all of the British people would have had to bail them out just because of the actions of this one guy. Now, this one was for some reason allowed to go under. But I wonder how many other times it's happened.
Asian coast, Kota Kinabalu.
We just spent a normal weekend in Kota Kinabalu.
Did you tell Lisa?
No. Still waiting to see what the situation is. I never expected Barings to go past.
Did you ask yourself at that point why this had all happened?
No. It was, you know, a combination of errors. You know, I should have referred it to people. I didn't, and it escalated. I don't think that there is a simpler explanation.
Late on the Sunday night, the Bank of England decided it was impossible to save Barings. Next day, traders pushed the market down. Leeson's losses doubled from over £400 million to £830 million in one day, and the oldest merchant bank in Britain was no more. 2 days later, Nick and Lisa left Kota Kinabalu for Frankfurt.
Did you talk on the flight?
No. No, we didn't talk. Actually, I don't really talk on a flight anyway. Wherever I'm going, I'll just watch the film and sleep. I'm not being funny, but I didn't want to be talking about it. I didn't want to know. I just didn't.
Why not?
Because I suppose I didn't want it to be real.
For, you know, a boy from Watford to bring a grand firm down, I mean, it was a social insult as well. It wasn't even one of their own kind. Which is where I suppose the smugness comes in, isn't it? It simply can't happen to chaps like us. You know, I mean, we're Barings.
Well, things like that didn't happen. I mean, just didn't happen.
Are you to Barings or to banks?
Well, it does happen to banks. Not always the same way, but it does. No, to Barings.
We found one of Nick's photographs in the drawer, and we put Nick's photograph up, and we say, Nick, we do respect you. He can do it. Who can do it? Nobody else can do it, to bring down such a big bank. And remember when he spoke to some of the traders, and they all say, oh, what would you like to be? And he say, I would never want to be rich. I want to be famous. I want to be well-liked. And so when things happen, we say, oh, Nick, you made it.
What would be your message tonight to Peter Baring, if he's watching?
I don't know. I mean, I don't really have a message to Peter Baring. I
felt the first interview was very controlled. I think we're still probably seeing mirrors. And we're probably still seeing somebody who feels powerful in his ability to fool us. And is sustained by that.
And however naive and stupid this may sound, I was always working in the best interests of the bank.
I think he's difficult. A guy who is living out a dream, playing out his fantasy as the rogue trader, when in reality, he's just an accountant cooking the books.
You keep making excuses. That's all we keep on doing is making excuses. And sometimes I'm cheesed off we keep making excuses. And I think, why should we keep making excuses? You know, I just want to ask Nick. It's no good us keep saying what I think is. No one knows unless Nick, until Nick actually says, well, the reason I did it was. Maybe he doesn't even know himself.
I really don't care what people think. I don't care what you think. I don't care what the average man in the street thinks. I think that they are typically on my side. That's the impression I get from the letters that I receive while I'm in here. But it's not something that really matters to me.
Why are they on your side?
I don't know. Ask them.
What are you, then? If you don't care about what people think, what are you like?
Why does it matter? You know, the only people that really... To answer that question, the only people that I'm really answering that question to are the people who care, who matter to me. And, you know, I don't think it's a question that's worth answering.
Double your money and try to get rich. Double your money without any hitch. Double your money, it's your lucky day. Double your money and take it away.
Well, well, well. Interesting. Very interesting, friends. Obviously, there's obviously some psychological issue with Nick Leeson, but it's pretty scary. You know, we talk about managerial oversight and managerialism, but the absence of proper managerialism allows this sort of thing to happen. So, you know, and that's a, you know, they were giving him like £300 million a day and things like that. I mean, it's kind of crazy. Half of all of their assets were just in this one hidden account. So that is what happens when there is a lack of managerial oversight. I mean, frankly, my view is that it is that much of the activity that goes on in these places should just outright not be allowed, because it doesn't, you know, it doesn't benefit anybody, and it's basically parasitic on the you know, on the rest of the economy. And over financialization has basically ruined all of our countries. But anyway, that's a matter for another day. Hope you enjoyed this. It needs 7,800, no exceptions, for this to carry on. And I like I said, there's not going to be any super chats because I have to get out of here. See you next time, friends. Do buy my courses. Now get out. Oh, this one.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.